To say he's academically accomplished is to understate his credentials. His undergraduate and graduate work in economics was capped by a PhD and a Master of Philosophy in Policy Analysis from RAND. He's an expert in what he does, but he didn't start out that way. He started out as a French horn player. He tells the story in the July 2019 issue of The Atlantic. As a child, I had just one goal, to be the world's greatest French horn player. I worked at it slavishly, practicing hours a day, seeking out the best teachers, and playing in any ensemble I could find. I had pictures of famous horn players on my bedroom wall for inspiration, and for a while, I thought my dream might come true. But then, in my early 20s, a strange thing happened. I started getting worse. To this day, I have no idea why. My technique began to suffer. I had no explanation for it. Nothing helped. I visited great teachers and practiced more, but I couldn't get back to where I had been. Pieces that had been easy to play became hard. Pieces that had been hard became impossible. Brooks eventually understood that, for whatever reason, his singular goal of being the world's greatest French horn player was never to be achieved. That dream was over. His challenge was to move to excellence in something else, and he did. Arthur Brooks is not a quitter. What happened to his playing was beyond his control, and he shifted, rather than abandoned, his pursuit of excellence. A quitter is someone who has the meaningful option not to quit, but does so anyway. The act of quitting is known only to the person who does it, and is not always obvious to the onlooker. A lot of people quit, and the world doesn't see it. A lot of people quit, and the world excuses it. They excuse it because the polite assumption is that, well, they found a different path, as Arthur Brooks did. But quitting is always obvious on the inside, to the person who does it. There is always the voice that acknowledges that you could do better. There is always the voice that whispers you could have kept on. There is always the voice that quietly informs you that you didn't do your best. I have spent nearly my entire life trying to silence that voice. That doesn't mean I haven't heard it. I have. I have succumbed to it at times. I remember it vividly the first time. It was my eighth grade year, and we were back in Houston after a year in Ecuador. Soccer was my sport, and before moving to Ecuador, I played on a club team in Houston called the Hurricanes. I was pretty good, not overly skilled, but a valuable player. My value was in my intensity. My comparative lack of skill was more than compensated for by my work ethic. I ran harder than most and played harder than most. I never dragged. I never felt sorry for myself on field or off. My internal motivation was strong. I had a sense of duty toward myself, an obligation to excellence for its own sake. I had a sense of duty toward my teammates. I wasn't going to let myself down, and I wasn't going to let them down. My coaches noticed. They knew Crenshaw would play his heart out. I vindicated their trust. But my motivation and character were not unblemished. There was a flip side to my drive and intensity. When I was young, I had a real problem with losing. In fact, if I had lost on the soccer field, I would act like a crybaby. The problem went way past soccer. For example, I'll never forget losing my cool and surrendering to real anger and fury at the tender age of 8 because my mother beat me in a croquet match. In that case, my rage was twofold. Not only did I lose, she should have let me win. I have to say, there are some things I'm glad got beaten out of me. By mom, by dad, and by life. She looked at me, perplexed by my outrage, and wondered aloud why on earth I should be allowed to win. I didn't earn it. My croquet skills were not good enough to win. You don't get to win just because you feel entitled to it. Your status as an 8-year-old does not beget privileges that outweigh your merits. Croquet, sports, and life are meritocracies by which you shall be judged on your performance and the content of your character. Thank you, Mom and Dad. The fear of losing wasn't quite beaten out of me when I was 13, though. I still hated losing, but my mentality was evolving at least, evolving into a healthier sense of competition and a desire to win. When I first moved to Ecuador, my parents enrolled me in a summer soccer camp at the local American school. During one scrimmage, my team lost. I was devastated, and I let my emotions get the best of me. It was embarrassing. But at least I never felt entitled to the win. What I had failed to understand is what I understand now. The problem isn't failing. The problem is when you choose to fail and rationalize that choice. Only you can know the difference. When I started my seventh grade year at Academia Cotopaxi, an American school in Quito, my father made me practice with my school's varsity soccer team, even though I was on the junior varsity team. I hated it at first. Junior varsity showcased my dominance. Varsity practice exposed my shortcomings. Then, though, I got better. By the time we returned to Texas only a year later, the varsity squad down in Ecuador had made me a pretty good soccer player. Back in Houston, I returned to my old soccer team, the Hurricanes. The coach was psyched to see me. He thought I was going to be his secret weapon, because I had just spent a year in South America in a real soccer culture. I, too, thought I would sail through practice, tryouts, and right back to the starting lineup, back to winning state championships like we had only a couple years earlier. But the first few practices went badly. Small mistakes led to small losses in confidence. Small losses in confidence became big losses in confidence. What I needed to do was refocus, re-engage, explore the reasons for my paradoxical decrease in performance, and fix whatever was needed. I had just spent an entire year doing pretty well as a player in South America. I should have been blowing everyone away. I didn't do any of that. Faced with my own diminished performance and unwilling to accept responsibility, not just for the problem, but for the solution too, I adopted a teenage posture of apathy and decided not to care. More accurately, I decided to pretend not to care. I made a choice. I chose to quit. Quitting was my plan B. With the existence of plan B, my failure became inevitable. At tryouts, I didn't make the cut. The coaches could see my fire and the gut was extinguished. Deep down, I knew I had poured water and sand directly onto that fire. I heard that little voice inside, whispering that I could have done better, that I could have kept on, that I did not do my best. It was right. Right after that, we moved again, this time to Bogota, Colombia. It was for the best because the change of scenery gave me a chance to reflect, revise, and reset. I had quit once, and I can keenly recall that teenage apathy was setting in. But that didn't mean I had to live as a quitter. In the more competitive soccer leagues of Colombia, I brought myself back. I excelled and finished my high school years as the starting forward on the varsity team. You don't entertain the plan B option because when you do, you're entertaining failure. And in entertaining failure, you will embrace it. Ultimately, the no plan B mentality isn't about keeping you from doing something, rather it is about embracing a positive goal as your only choice. It is about enabling you to do something. It's about clearing the paths to your goals, to your achievements, to your tasks, to your responsibilities. The importance of no plan B as it relates to responsibility is worth spending a moment on. Living responsibly, cleaning your room, paying your taxes, treating people with respect, the basics, is a core element of personal success. Deeper than that, it is a core element of America's foundation in liberty. It has to be. After all, how can you trust a people with liberty if they choose to live within their plan B, devoid of responsibility? You can't. A generation back, in 1995, St. John Paul II reminded an audience of Americans at Camden Yards in Baltimore that the meeting of those tasks and responsibilities is the very essence of our national character. He said, "Every generation of Americans needs to know that freedom consists not in doing what we like, but in having the right to do what we ought." The Pope was getting at a foundational truth of American society. We are not founded on unbridled freedom that consists of doing what we like. We are founded on ordered liberty. This is an important difference. The Statue of Liberty is not a representation of pure freedom, but of liberty supported by the rule of law, both legislative and moral in nature. When French sculptor Frédéric Auguste Bartholdi designed Lady Liberty, he placed a tabula ansata in her left hand, evoking the concept of law. Inscribed on the tablet is the date of the Declaration of Independence, July 4, 1776. There is important symbolism here. First is the notion that our liberty is based on a legal and moral order. And second, the purpose of government as outlined by the Declaration of Independence. Our government exists to protect our inalienable God-given rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The purpose of government as per the Declaration of Independence is to protect the right to do what we ought. Pure freedom is chaos, anarchy, and moral decay. Freedom to do what you like, without any moral compass, can quickly result in the temptation to indulge in habits that may feel good momentarily, but are wholly detrimental to yourself and others. Pure freedom, detached from a higher sense of purpose, results at best in overindulgence, lack of discipline, unfaithful relationships, and some minor drug use. At worst, it can result in the total deterioration of a society as moral relativism takes hold and humanity's darkest proclivities become justified in the name of doing what we like. Ordered liberty is at the heart of our founding, not pure freedom. Ordered liberty is the understanding that law exists to prevent individuals from infringing on the inalienable rights of others. As French philosopher Frédéric Bastiat observed in 1850, the law exists only to secure justice. And justice is defined as the protection of one's life, liberty, and property. As our founders argued, and St. John Paul II would have certainly agreed with, our laws must also be written in the context of a higher moral calling, derived from God and the teachings of the Bible. After all, our laws can be traced to the Ten Commandments, whether you believe in God or not. This is what St. John Paul II was saying when he mentioned having the right to do what we ought. Our society's foundation came with an understanding that we would not only live free, but that we would live with good intent and moral purpose. As John Adams said, "Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other." The gift of liberty is accompanied by an expectation of living responsibly, both in the practical and moral sense. A person living their plan B, effectively quitting on themselves and on those depending on them, cannot be said to be living responsibly. By the time we set up house in Bogota, where I spent my high school years, the question of what we ought to do was pretty well answered in my head. I was going to be a SEAL. My dad had given me Marcinko's Rogue Warrior, and I was hooked. Around this time, I also watched the 1990 movie Navy SEALs, starring Charlie Sheen, which I sheepishly admit only deepened my determination. Like most teenage boys, I wasn't an avid consumer of high-concept art and literature. Sheen's movies are not known for that. But I did have an eye for the truth at the heart of books and movies, and both Marcinko and Sheen managed to communicate something vital about the SEALs. This was a community of men who worked hard, played hard, and didn't quit. For young Dan Crenshaw, it was message received. I added SEAL training to the list of teenage to-dos in my already unique set of experiences growing up in Colombia. On weekends, I was trying, unsuccessfully, to fit in by learning to dance merengue and cumbia. I was also reading up on SEALs in Vietnam. I didn't just train for the varsity soccer team, on which I was a starting forward. I also got into weightlifting and calisthenics to better prepare for a future at BUDS. During my junior year, our class took a field trip to the beautiful Caribbean island of Providencia. It belongs to Colombia, much to the chagrin of the Panamanians. Freed from the burden of American-style liability laws, our school allowed us to embark upon an eco-challenge. We were split into small groups, given a map, a compass, and a machete, and told to get from point A to point B in the wilderness of the island. It was one of the coolest experiences of my high school years. My classmates were thinking, "This is an experience I'll never forget." But I was thinking, SEAL training. I had my plan A. When I got to BUDS and met my peers there, I found that I wasn't alone. Nearly everyone present had harbored a singular goal of becoming a SEAL for most of their lives. This was no casual commitment. You didn't sign up for BUDS on a whim. For the first time in my life, I was in a community of men who had dispensed with any thought of a plan B. Having no plan B, I knew I would be a SEAL, and I pursued only that goal, with all other goals, including my college education, subordinated to it. Meant that I gave my all to my efforts over a period of years. Every major decision was made in service of that pursuit. It made those decisions simple. It made life simple. It did not, though, make life easy, and that's good. Things that are easy are often less rewarding. Hard work in pursuit of a dream? Now that's a reward. My goal drove my action, and my action propelled me to my goal. The personal challenge associated with those actions was a reward in itself. This is a point worth noting. A goal isn't necessarily the only end. Let's say I spent my youth pursuing the goal of becoming a SEAL, and for reasons outside my control, which is to say, for reasons other than quitting, I didn't make it. In fact, I almost didn't, thanks to a fractured tibia bone during my first hell week. I had to start all over. But would that mean all the effort was squandered and meaningless? Not at all. For one thing, the preparation to become a SEAL, physical fitness, academic excellence, leadership positions, character development, is nothing more or less than preparation for life. We should hope every American seeks and embraces something similar for themselves in preparation for simple citizenship. The time and effort was never wasted. Even if I was never commissioned, to say nothing of becoming a SEAL, it would never have been wasted. There's another and deeper reason it would have been time well spent. Purpose is meaning, and meaning is happiness. We don't think about happiness enough, and when we do not necessarily think about it properly. Happiness is neither joy nor entertainment. It is an ontological condition, fundamental to our existence as humans. It's notable that when the founders drafted the Declaration of Independence, they listed up front three things to which we are entitled: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's two things that we ought to have as such, and one thing that we deserve merely to pursue. The founders didn't think government could or should guarantee happiness. They only knew it should clear the path for us to chase it. The chase, you see, is the point. The pursuit is the purpose. When I ran for Congress in early 2018, Marcus Luttrell was kind enough to have me on his podcast. You may know Marcus as the author of Lone Survivor. That story is one of the great battlefield epics of the post-9/11 American history. Marcus, Danny Dietz, Michael Murphy, and Matt Axelson took on hundreds of Taliban fighters in the mountains of Afghanistan. Only Marcus lived to tell the tale. It's no accident his podcast is entitled Never Quit. Marcus asks every guest to tell their never quit story. He asked me mine. When he asked, I requested that he stop recording. I needed to think. I wanted to get this right. This was the most important thing that I could share with his audience. Not the war stories, not the tales of camaraderie and suffering in the field. This, how to never quit. After a few seconds, it came to me. Here's what I said. You have purpose in this life. God has you here for a reason. You may not know it, but He does. Your job is to find it. No one else can. You need to understand that your purpose may be great in the eyes of the world, or it may be commonplace and seemingly small. Your purpose might be your family, your children. Your purpose might be tutoring a child and changing their life. Your purpose might be the business you started. Your purpose might be cleaning up your block. Your purpose might be in the help you give others. Your purpose might be in the example you set. Only you and God know. Only you and God need to know. Search until you find it, and until then, act as if you have it, because you're wasting time otherwise. As my friend Ben Shapiro writes, you were designed to use your reason and your natural gifts, and to cultivate those assets toward fulfillment of a higher end. Your purpose allows for no plan B. Maybe this sounds religious. I'm not a man who wears his faith on his sleeve. Make no mistake, though, this is religious. The Bible tells us to embrace our purpose, and even suggests what it might be. St. John Paul II was probably riffing off Galatians 5:13, "For you were called to freedom, brothers, only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another." I'm not here to persuade you that the Bible ought to be your moral touchstone from which you derive purpose and meaning. There is a higher and better qualified authority who can work on that. My point is that this question of purpose touches upon themes fundamental to our existence on this earth. Focusing on purpose centers your actions, even the small ones, around a cause. It's helpful in maintaining a sense of stability and direction when, say, a television comedian is leveraging your war injury for a joke. It's also helpful when you're at Bud's in the middle of Hell Week and realizing that it is, in fact, hellish. Bud's brings cold, fatigue, sleep deprivation, fear of drowning, hunger, and sand to bear in the world's toughest training environment. The sand, so beautiful to onlookers visiting the pristine beaches of Coronado, actually acts as the unspoken horror of Bud's. It gets everywhere, and it thoroughly scours your entire body. During Hell Week, when we are soaking wet at all times, the sand combines with your fatigues to create the perfect 100-grain fine sandpaper against your skin, making Bud students the most well-exfoliated people on the planet. Not surprisingly, the temptation is to quit. Hell, it goes beyond temptation. It is a burning impulse, mercilessly encouraged by the instructors. There are two things to understand about quitting Buds. The first is that the 6-month experience, and Hell Week in particular, is designed to bring those quitting thoughts to the fore. If you think you've ever been miserable before, you'll find you were wrong when you encounter true misery at Buds. Buds makes up for the past century of comparative ease we have enjoyed in the post-industrial age. Buds practically invites you to quit, and you've got instructors yelling often and early at you about just how easy it would be. Some men listen, and they start to think about it. They start to think about what it would be like to take a hot shower. They imagine eating a nice dinner. They think about the feeling of a warm bed. They allow themselves to miss the embrace of a wife or a girlfriend. They do all this as they are shivering uncontrollably, as salt water is stinging small abrasions across their bodies, and while holding aloft a boat or a log well past the point of muscle failure. They start to form their plan B. Maybe I really don't want to be a SEAL anyway. I would still be happy doing something else in the Navy, right? The second thing to understand about quitting Buds is it is a very public process. There's a brass bell, polished daily by dutiful Bud students, right outside the instructor's office where much of your suffering takes place. But to make the process of quitting even more convenient, the instructors bring the bell to each evolution, each boat race, log race, obstacle course run, 2-mile ocean swim, all of it. The instructors want it to be easy to ring that bell. If you decide to quit and they start driving you back to the office, you may change your mind. They don't want that. They want it to be right in front of you at all times. They want to take advantage of that small moment of weakness you have. They make sure you know there are coffee, donuts, and warm blankets waiting for you. Over and over, you are reminded that your suffering ends the moment you walk up to that bell and ring it 3 times. There is a calculus here, and it is much more sophisticated and goes much deeper than just cruel hazing techniques. They make quitting easy and convenient because they want to weed out the people who have the shortest mental path to Plan B. In combat, we have no use for those people. They are dangerous, in fact. If quitting is an option when your life isn't on the line, there is no telling what you will do when lives are on the line. Sometimes I've wondered if there were actually coffee and donuts, as the instructors so frequently promised. I never found out. Ultimately, it didn't matter to me. It also didn't matter to the fewer than 1 in 5 of my peers who made it to the end of Buds. That was why we were left standing at the end. More than that, we lived according to a purpose. The smallest of tasks, habits, and decisions were executed in service of the higher goal of earning the SEAL Trident. A no plan B mindset is useful for the big goals like Buds, recovering from my blast injuries, or running for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. But it is the small choices that matter just as much. After all, your big goals are accomplished by an infinite number of smaller decisions. Resisting your temptation to accept Plan B is more than just not quitting. It is also refusing to engage in bad, unproductive, and immoral behavior, even when it seems unimportant. It is the refusal to cut corners on that report for your boss, turn in an essay that meets only the bare minimum of standards, or lie to a friend or spouse. Will you decide to skip that workout, Plan B, because you're tired? Or go to the gym, Plan A? Will you decide to throw your trash on the ground when no one is looking, Plan B? Or save it until you find a trash can, Plan A? Will you decide to put that extra hour into your resume before sending it in, or decide that it's good enough? You refuse to do these things because the proper standard of behavior is Plan A, a life lived with purposeful and good intent. And Plan B is the shortcut that chips away at your success. When I ran for office in an against-all-odds Republican primary, I did so without a Plan B. This isn't to say I neglected to consider my career options after March 6 in case I lost. It would have been irresponsible not to set aside some savings and think pragmatically about the future. But the truth was that I didn't waste an ounce of effort or time dwelling on the possibility. Every small decision was purposeful and oriented toward winning. We relied on our personal savings in order to survive. We worked out of my parents' game room in Spring, Texas. We didn't waste a penny on any luxury. Every day was hyper-focused on connecting with new voters and spreading the message that I believed was right for America. The big goal was winning the election, and the smaller daily goals were the supporting efforts. Every day I faced a choice to sleep in or get up and start working. Every day we could fit in one more event on the calendar, or we could take a break. More often than not, as you might have guessed, we chose Plan A every day. Plan A led to victory, and I'll never know what Plan B even was. This approach has a proud history in America. What works for individual Americans, perseverance toward a higher purpose, has also worked for America, not surprisingly. We are, after all, a country whose success relies upon responsible citizens who fulfill personal duty and purpose. From George Washington to Harriet Tubman to the men on the beaches of Normandy, American history has been deeply inspired by a no-plan B mindset. America has been successful because the backup plan was never an option. We are a nation unique in world history that is built upon purpose rather than geography or ethnicity. America exists because of a proposition about the nature of humankind, that our nature is not to be forcefully molded by government, but instead that government exists to protect our inalienable rights. In exchange, we expect our citizens to live dutifully, morally, and responsibly. That purpose has informed us in our national destiny at key moments throughout our existence. At the close of 1776, the Continental Army was near dissolution. Summer and fall had seen defeat upon defeat, with the British driving General George Washington's forces from Long Island, from Manhattan, and from Westchester. Having lost the region of New York City, the humiliation of the Americans was crowned with a dispiriting retreat across a frozen and desolated New Jersey until the armies came to rest facing one another across the icy Delaware River. Washington had remaining with him a tiny force, poorly supplied, and with the experience of defeat fresh on their spirits. The hopes of America were dimmed and shortly to be extinguished. Therefore, General Washington and the Continental Army, outnumbered, outgunned, and out of hope, attacked. They shocked the Hessian garrison at Trenton with a Christmas assault and won. Days later, they fought again at Trenton and held off the British main force. Then, deceiving their foes, they disengaged from Trenton and surprised the British garrison at Princeton, defeating it entirely. On Christmas Eve, 1776, the British assumed that America would be extinguished within weeks. Weeks later, they were evacuating nearly all of New Jersey because George Washington and the Continentals refused to stay beaten. Washington's sheer will to triumph accepted nothing less than victory, and victory followed. Just over 1 year later, with the British finally in possession of the American capital at Philadelphia, His Majesty King George III sent a peace commission to the rebellious Americans. Here's what that commission offered to the Continental Congress in June 1778. Peace, trade, American consent to any British forces in America, British aid for American public debts, full American self-rule under the crown, American representation in Parliament. The British, in short, offered the Americans a wish list of concessions beyond the wildest dreams of any revolutionary radical before July 4, 1776. But this was after July 4, 1776. America wasn't fighting for a good deal within the British Empire now. America was fighting to be free. America had its purpose. America had no plan B. So, 8 days after receiving the Peace Commission's proposal, the Continental Congress sent back its reply. No. For America, it would be full independence or nothing. Against the world's mightiest empire, which also happened to be occupying the American capital at that moment, they said no. Our purpose was independence and freedom, and it wasn't negotiable. It isn't just purpose that saved us. It is purpose that made us. It was this purpose that authored the American story as we know it. In our lives now, I think we have an obligation to live up to that truth. Never quit. No plan B. Plan B is an alternate universe which only you can choose to engage in. It should be less satisfying in every single way because it represents a lesser version of yourself, the anti-hero. It represents the version that decided to give up and convince yourself that you never really wanted your dream in the first place. It is a habit that must be broken in order to develop the fortitude necessary to face life's challenges. Leaving Plan B behind means you believe that you will succeed, even if it kills you. It is a marker of the mentally tough, because to quit is to choose weakness. It is the decision to live with good moral intent and purpose, to live dutifully. It is the decision to take every small choice seriously, because it is the small habits that drive you toward your purpose and ultimately your success. Your purpose is yours. So is the choice of whether to fulfill it. Chapter 4. Be Still. The CH-47 Chinook helicopter, those giant two-rotor air beasts that can carry way more weight than seems physically possible for a helicopter, packed with 30 men and two dogs, approaches the landing zone, or LZ, after a two-hour transit. The small clearing, tucked behind a small mountain or large hill, is about 10 kilometers away from the target, a cluster of mud buildings where we believe a Taliban shadow government meeting to be taking place. The LZ was chosen carefully so that the sound of the helicopter would not alert anyone nearby. Previous aerial ISR, or intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, revealed this area to be pretty desolate, making it ideal for an insertion location. We began preparation for landing. The sound of magazines being inserted into the magwells of our SCAR heavy rifles and M4s reverberates throughout the fuselage. The bolts are slammed forward, each chambering a round. Infrared lasers attached to the barrels of our guns are turned on and quickly tested. Helmets are adjusted, and night vision goggles, or NODs for short, are turned on and focused. Rucks are tightened onto backs, adjusted so that all the first-line gear, gun, magazines, NODs, and so on, is not interfered with during our 10-kilometer patrol to the target. When you walk off the ramp, you must be ready for all things that war may bring. We exit and form into a pre-planned security perimeter. We stop, look, listen, and smell. We call this simple action SLLS, pronounced SILS. After any activity, in this case a helicopter landing, there is a disturbance in the environment. Someone might have heard you or seen you. Maybe it was locals. Maybe it was the enemy. It is standard operating procedure to take a minute, be silent, and observe the environment. Silence. Nothing. We begin moving. 2 hours later, we wake up an unsuspecting enemy and ruin their night. SILS, which also kind of sounds like still, hence the name of this chapter, is simply a reminder to stop and observe your surroundings every once in a while. It is a patrolling tactic, but I attribute far more meaning to the term than simple tactical procedure. For our purposes, it is a mindset to live by. It is a reminder to literally be still. Don't overreact. Don't let your emotions drive your action. Think before you act. In other words, stop and count to 10, like your mom and dad taught you. This is stillness in the stoic sense. SEAL training never mentions the word stoic, but it certainly teaches the principles. The best doctrines to live by, the ones that lead to the best outcomes and the happiest people, are generally the oldest ones, having stood the test of time across centuries of human history, trial and error, and diverse experiences. So, if people have been reading Marcus Aurelius for almost 2,000 years, then there might be something to that. Marcus Aurelius was an accomplished Roman general and emperor, considered one of the last good emperors before the Pax Romana ended in the 2nd century AD. He was an ardent follower of the Stoic philosophy, founded by Zeno of Citium in Athens in 301 BC, and the author of the great philosophical work, Meditations. Stoics had a few things to say about outrage and unbridled emotions, though they didn't call it outrage culture. They called it passion. In modern times, we usually define passion as intense enthusiasm or conviction. One can be passionate about their work, for instance, but can also be defined as strong and barely controllable emotion or an outbreak of anger, which is how the Stoics use the word. There's a big difference in those two definitions, so it's important to distinguish them for our purposes. Being passionate about your work and being in a state of barely controllable emotion are two very different things. Stoics were highly critical of the latter. Marcus Aurelius wrote, "The mind which is free from passions is a citadel, for man has nothing more secure to which he can fly for refuge and for the future be inexpugnable." He went on to say, "Let thy chief fort and place of defense be a mind free from passions. A stronger place and better fortified than this hath no man." According to the Stoics, mental toughness and freedom from passion were directly related. A mind free from passion is a citadel and fortified. I think this is a fairly intuitive concept. After all, what does an intense emotional outburst get us? Do you make better decisions when you're angry? Do raw displays of emotion improve anyone's opinion of us? Probably not. Aurelius addresses the utter futility of heightened passions and the need for perspective. Run down the list of those who felt intense anger at something, the most famous, the most unfortunate, the most hated, the most whatever. Where is all that now? Smoke, dust, legend, or not even a legend. Think of all the examples and how trivial the things we want so passionately are. An emotional response is a human response. I get it. I, too, have succumbed to emotion more often than I care to admit. But it is also a futile response. It isn't an objectively beneficial response. This is central to Stoicism. Stoic wisdom has guided men through experiences that make buds look like a day at the beach. Although, I suppose, technically, a lot of buds was literally a day at the beach. You get the picture. Take, for example, the late American hero and Medal of Honor recipient Vice Admiral James Stockdale, who endured years of hell in the Hanoi Hilton. Admiral Stockdale had spent years absorbing Stoic thought, in particular the teachings of philosopher Epictetus. In a 1995 lecture at Quantico, he spoke of the day 30 years prior when he was shot down over North Vietnam. It was the first day of 7 years of brutal captivity. Imprisoned, isolated, wounded, and often tortured, Stockdale had little but his faith and the perennial teachings of the great Stoics. During his speech, he said, "What I had in hand was the understanding that the Stoic, particularly the disciple of Epictetus, who developed this accounting, always keeps separate files in his mind for A, those things which are up to him, and B, those things which are not up to him. Among the relatively few things that are up to me, within my power, within my will, are my opinions, my aims, my aversions, my own grief, my own joy, my moral purpose or will, my attitude toward what is going on, my own good and my own evil." Subjected to torture, deprivation, and humiliation for the following 7 years, Stockdale was wholly reduced to the relatively few things that are up to me, within my power. Yet it was enough. He survived. He survived specifically because of that Stoic mindset, which simultaneously gave him a sense of control and a sense of reality. More than 35 years later, the writer Jim Collins in Good to Great would call this juxtaposition the Stockdale paradox. The aged vice admiral told him, "You must never confuse faith that you will prevail in the end, which you can never afford to lose, with the discipline to confront the most brutal facts of your current reality, whatever they might be." It is a mindset instantly familiar to any SEAL. And with apologies to Collins, it's no paradox. Stillness is not a denial of reality. It makes it possible to deal with reality. It is a source of power. The power to honestly assess what is in your control and what is not. It's the power to be wet and cold and miserable at buds and acknowledge that you are all those things and still not ring the bell. It's the power of a single mom struggling to make ends meet, acknowledge that hardship, but persevere anyway. It's the power to eject from your doomed A4 Skyhawk on September 9th, 1965. And as you're descending beneath your parachute, think, 5 years down there at least, I'm leaving the world of technology and entering the world of Epictetus. That inner dialogue, as he floated down into enemy territory, was his first act of survival. Acceptance for what you truly can't control, but responsibility for what you can control. The Stoic does not believe in categorizing so many things as outside your control that you simply become a victim of circumstance. Far more is within your control than you might think. Responsibility for what you can control leads to the power to defeat outrage culture. As Stockdale said in another of his talks on Stoicism and Epictetus, there can be no such thing as being the victim of another. You can only be a victim of yourself. It's all in how you discipline your mind. No victimhood, no outrage. That's the promise and the value of stillness. The alternative is unreasoned emotion. In many cases, you can rationalize and justify your emotional response to a comment or headline or tough question, but we shouldn't pretend that the emotional response leads to a better outcome. Unless the goal is to manipulate other people's emotions, the goal of a political activist, for instance, then outrage is neither a moral nor a productive response. To be clear, I hope your goal is not to manipulate the emotions of others. And I also hope that in some small way I can encourage you to be more skeptical of those passionate talking heads that seek to manipulate yours. Speaking of mass media talking heads who like to spin their viewers into a hysterical frenzy, here's another scenario, post-military career. I'm starting out in politics and getting used to being on live TV and answering tough interview questions. Sometimes the questions are fair. Sometimes they are designed to surprise you. Sometimes they are simply gotcha questions meant to elicit a controversial response. Putting aside for a second why journalists see any value in gotcha questions or what value they bring to public discourse, let's just agree that they are the norm these days. The producers told us there would be a certain set of topics, and we trusted the news anchor wouldn't veer from that. But of course they do. They ask a question midway through the interview that is less of a question and more of a moral judgment wrapped up in a question atop a false premise. For instance, how can you support a tax bill that hurts America's workers? Being surprised on live TV in front of millions of viewers isn't easy to deal with if you are prone to quick emotional reactions. So, don't be. Be still. When I went on Saturday Night Live, the producers were pretty nervous that I wouldn't be funny, which was a fair assumption considering the many unfunny politicians who had appeared previously. They were nervous that I was going to be too nervous. I explained to them that I was used to preparing for live interviews where anything could be asked of you. Reading rehearsed lines on cue cards would be a cakewalk. Part of preparing for these difficult moments is simply anticipating them ahead of time, imagining the scenarios you might be confronted with, called wargaming in the military and just preparation in normal parlance, is an effective tool to blunt the emotional effect that events may have on you. Your nervous system will simply be more ready for it. The ancient Stoics called this premeditatio malorum, or the premeditation of evils. Seneca, the first century Roman Stoic philosopher, was famous for meticulously imagining all the potential pitfalls of a journey before departing. He wrote, "Nothing happens to the wise man against his expectation." In politics, we watch how an interviewer asks questions and what talking points they use. We get a sense for how fair or unfair they might be and what kind of topics they usually cover. Then we practice answering questions that are meant to confuse and distract. We get better at it. Early on in my career, I was far less experienced with such gotcha questions. I remember one interview on CNN discussing my campaign. At one point, the host went off topic and asked me, "Are you comfortable with the fact that President Trump has not visited a military base in a combat zone since becoming president?" Let's unpack what this question was meant to do. On its face, it isn't a crazy question to ask of a former service member turned politician. On the other hand, one might question why such a topic would be newsworthy at all. unless the goal was to create a narrative that President Donald Trump was a bad guy who didn't care about the troops. The intent of the question was obvious: imply a character flaw in the president and get me to reactively agree with that character flaw. That in turn would generate a round of news headlines: retired Navy SEAL turned GOP candidate questions President Trump's ability as commander-in-chief. Normal tactics for CNN, which, like all cable news networks, favors spectacle and drama over informing the public. But the bad faith aspect of the question no longer mattered because it was asked on live TV, where there was no escaping it. They could have acted in good faith and told me they wanted to discuss it, which is a common practice in the world of cable news producers. So I could have reviewed the facts surrounding the topic instead of relying on CNN's narrow and likely biased explanation. But they didn't. It was totally unexpected. I never wargamed it. So I had to fall back on deeper training, back to being still. On live TV, and especially on short news interviews, you don't get to roll your eyes. Well, you can, it's just not a great idea. Or hem and haw and scratch your head while you think about the question. You have to just answer. And your answer better not suck. Being still is about acting properly under pressure. And so I did that. I gave them an answer that would still push back against their premise that the president was a bad guy in a coherent way. I said something to the effect of, I was in the military for 10 years. I never once saw a president visit a base, and I felt that I could do my job just fine. The president gives our generals and troops the ability to execute the mission we've given them. Troops feel like the president has their backs. Not perfect, but it didn't suck either. Crisis averted. The calm inside the storm quality takes practice. It's hard to know you even have that quality until you have been tested. Some people develop it through experience and adversity, others through training. The best and most emotionally resilient people develop it through both hardship and hard training. But the unfortunate reality is that fewer and fewer Americans are developing that quality because, well, life has become too comfortable. We no longer need to hunt for our food, defend ourselves from mountain lions, or figure out how to get water. The simple act of not having to find new and reliable sources of water should collectively blow our minds. The notion that nobody in this vast country worries about dying of dehydration would astound our ancestors. The miracle of modernity has done some amazing things, but it has also softened us a great deal. The likelihood of experiencing a truly harrowing situation, let alone many of them, is near zero, and our resilience has suffered for it. This means you'll never know how you would react, and it means you have very few opportunities to practice for it when the time comes. It is one reason why even the smallest hardships elicit emotional breakdowns from many Americans, why so many are diagnosed with anxiety disorders, and why therapy and psychiatry are booming industries. Prior generations would be bewildered by the strange upward trend in both our fragility and our standard of living. The way we millennials and Gen Zers have been raised also plays a role. Haidt and Lukianoff, in The Coddling of the American Mind, observe that independent activities like walking by yourself to a friend's house are occurring later and later in life. Younger generations report that the first time they leave their home by themselves, to walk more than 6 blocks away, usually occurs around 5th grade. Older generations report 1st grade. This change has occurred despite the fact that the crime rate has fallen dramatically. Helicopter parenting, the incessant micromanagement of a child's activities, has created a generation of people who rarely experience conflict or traumatic situations, and as a result, they are more prone to emotional overreactions. The first way out of this mess is to simply choose not to be that person. Recall the importance of heroes? It's a valuable first step. Visualize what right looks like. If you want to be something, then you have to imagine being that first. Be someone who is cool under pressure. Value serenity instead of outrage. It seems that our culture is moving in the wrong direction here. If you are blessed enough to not be on social media, you might be surprised to learn that the angriest, most passionate public figures are rewarded with the most clicks and biggest audiences. Our culture has begun to confuse passion with substance, reward the loudest and angriest voices, and thus incentivize behavior wholly at odds with Stoic wisdom. The number of decibels your voice hits as you scream about how right you are is not necessarily an indicator of how much sense you are making. As a society founded on reason and Western Enlightenment ideals, we must hold ourselves to a higher standard. We have to collectively stop allowing emotion and passion to pass for reason and factual debate. In the SEAL teams, our first exercise in training the mind to be still is drown-proofing. And yes, it is as ridiculous as it sounds. As legend has it, and it may indeed just be legend, drown-proofing originates from the story of an American POW in Vietnam. As the Viet Cong transported him along the Mekong River, they decided they'd had enough of him and threw him overboard. But this was not some magnanimous gesture of human civility. He was not being released for good behavior. They expected him to drown. It was a reasonable expectation. His hands were tied behind his back and his feet were tied together. Visualize that for a second. This creates quite the predicament, especially when you are trying to not drown. He had to figure out how to swim to shore, and as the story goes, he did just that. Ever since, a key element of SEAL training involves drown-proofing us, making sure that we too can jump from a boat with our hands and feet tied. There are two ways to not drown when tied up. The first is to methodically bounce yourself off the bottom. You let yourself sink to the bottom, slowly exhaling, and calmly springboard yourself back up after you hit the bottom. You must launch yourself off the bottom strongly enough so that the apex of your jump just reaches the surface, and you can grab a quick breath. Launch too hard, and you will not only waste energy, but also throw off your apex. Launch too lightly, and you won't reach the surface and get that much-needed breath of air. If you panic, your rhythm will be broken, and you will become out of breath. You will drown. If the water is shallow enough, 10 to 15 feet, you can do this indefinitely, and even move forward in a given direction. During BUDS, we do practice this indefinitely. It is one of the easier challenges we face in the water. Few fail. Then there is the second part of drown-proofing. After all, it's hard to claim you are proofed if you can only survive in shallow water. SEALs need to be able to swim with their hands and feet tied together. You know, just in case. Even though real-life examples have proven elusive and the Vietnam story may be apocryphal. This is a little more challenging, and as you can imagine, it is much easier to panic. For starters, you may be surprised to learn that it is indeed possible to swim with your hands tied behind your back and your feet tied together. You do so by staying flat on your belly and methodically dolphin kicking while also maneuvering your head to barely clear the water. You sink slightly after taking a breath, kick, and let your full lungs float your upper body back up to the surface. It requires flawless execution to work. It also requires that you not panic. Imagine instructors screaming at the top of their lungs, "Don't panic!" as you calmly try and do this. The slightest amount of panic will cause you to sink, and you aren't coming back up once you've sunk even a little bit. There's no method for swimming up once you have started to sink. This exercise isn't about the tiny chance that you will be confronted with the aforementioned Vietnam scenario. That would be highly unlikely and terribly unlucky. The point of this training is to teach SEALs to engage in a deep calm when they need to. Many training scenarios build upon this, usually using the discomfort that being underwater brings with it as a training tool. For instance, we do underwater knot tying, during which an instructor ever so slowly examines your knot while you wait 15 feet below the surface on a breath hold. The knots are simple enough. Square, bowline, half hitch. But many people fail nonetheless, unable to be still. The culmination of underwater discomfort occurs during second phase in BUDS, also known as dive phase. During second phase, our big test is called pool comp, short for pool competency. This may be my least favorite test in BUDS, simply because I hate it when I can't breathe. I know, how wimpy of me. It involves a lengthy test during which you must conduct underwater problem solving with your open circuit scuba rig. Sounds simple enough, but it's not. First, we are equipped with the more classic version of modern dive equipment. Two large tanks on our back with a dual rubber hose regulator that feeds into both ends of the mouthpiece. The use of the traditional older style regulator for training is purposeful. It is easier for instructors to tie knots in your breathing hoses. Oh great, every new scuba student's dream. Pool comp begins with a surf hit, where an instructor attempts to simulate a large wave disorienting you while you dive. He grabs your mask just as you exhale, rips your regulator out of your mouth, goodbye sweet, sweet air supply, and begins spinning you around, all while adding a few jabs in the ribs for good measure. And of course, this particular quote-unquote wave also manages to tie your hoses in tight knots. What an amazingly complex wave. Then the test begins. Your job is to collect yourself and get your air working again, using the proper procedures. This is the key element of training, proper procedures. There are very specific steps required of you, in a specific order. You can't just rip off the rig. You have to feel the hoses behind you first. If you do remove the rig, you have to undo your straps in a specific order. Everything has to be done exactly to the prescribed method or you fail. You cannot shoot to the surface or you fail. You cannot do anything out of order or you fail. Remember, the goal is not actually to get good at fixing the dive rig. No one believes this particular scenario to be encountered in the real world, especially when we use these particular dive rigs only in training. Not a single SEAL remembers what these pool comp procedures actually were when asked years later. The goal is to force you to remain calm and perform a task in the worst of conditions, when you can't breathe or see. There were many moments when this training came in useful. In a gunfight, for instance. Yelling and screaming is a fairly natural reaction to bullets flying at your head, but it is also a useless reaction. Panic causes more panic, but calm breeds calm. So we are drilled day after day to be calm. Be still. One particular instance was my injury in 2012 in Afghanistan when I was hit by the IED blast. An initial instinct is always to scream. It feels good, it feels natural. There may even be some evolutionary reason why we scream in pain, perhaps to signal for help from others. But it doesn't matter. It isn't useful in combat. Your buddies know you got hurt. They don't need to hear you complain about it, too. But there was actually another life-threatening experience where being still truly mattered for me. It happened about a year after I survived my encounter with 15 pounds of explosives in Afghanistan. It happened on a beautiful, peaceful beach just outside Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Tara and I were on our honeymoon, exploring local beaches. I found a boogie board and decided I would try my luck with the waves, like I had done hundreds of times before in my life. The waves were solid, but it was difficult to swim past them to the breakpoint. Dragging the foam board through the surf was a difficult task, and I was putting in quite the effort to move past each set of waves. I was out of breath, and getting more out of breath with each large wave crashing over me. Not a big deal, I was fine. I could handle it. My heart rate was about at a quick jog. As long as nothing else disrupted that rhythm, I'd be fine. Then, an enormous wave broke right on me. The board was quickly detached from me, the cord breaking. The water was deep, too deep for me to ever touch the bottom. The wave was violent and kept me under for much longer than I expected. This was not the fake wave from pool comp. This was real. I struggled to get back to the surface, and when I finally did, I was completely exhausted, gasping for air. I was not a weak swimmer by any standard, Navy SEAL, remember? But this was kicking my ass. And then another wave hit. Same thing. So much turning in the water made it difficult to swim effectively because the bubbles prevent you from pulling through the water. All of a sudden, this situation was extremely dire. This particular set of waves was relentless. I was a good 100 yards from shore, and there were no lifeguards. There was no one to see me go under. That stillness training had never been more important. In that moment, it was even more important than the day I was hit by an IED. In Afghanistan, I had my teammates. On this secluded beach, I had no one. I consciously prevented myself from panicking and began breathing in slower, more methodical breaths. I began to problem solve. I quickly decided that despite the strong and reflexive urge to keep my gasping mouth above water, I would be better off if I dove into each coming wave just below it. In between waves, I slowly and calmly got on my back in a sort of lazy backstroke and moved towards shore. If I had attempted to stay afloat the normal way, treading water with bicycle kicks and circular arm motions, I believe I would have drowned. It's a crazy thing to say that a Navy SEAL, with my amount of training, could have been close to drowning, but I was. The situation was just that unexpected. And the only way to properly confront the unexpected is by facing it as calmly as possible. You never know when your life may be at stake. I eventually made it back to shore. My wife, Tara, looked up from her book. She asked, "Why do you look so tired? And where is the boogie board?" It's not fun for a Navy SEAL to tell their wife that they almost drowned. I'll put aside the dramatic stories, as I admit they are extreme examples. Because the truth is, your life is usually not at stake, but your reputation is, your relationships are, and your mental well-being is. And that's where this stoic ethos, the stillness that SEALs learn in the cold water, is instrumental to daily life. The disagreements with your spouse that get unnecessarily intense, frustration with a coworker, or political disagreements on social media. First of all, I want to say, maybe admit is a better word, that I am not some Zen master in my personal life. I have proven myself to be capable of maintaining my cool during political disagreements, near-drowning experiences, or debates, but I won't claim I am the best at doing the same during private conversations. I didn't write this book because I am perfect. Far from it. I just think I have a pretty good idea of what I should aspire to be. Romans 3:23 says that we have all sinned and fallen short of God's glory.